Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Jonathan Bennett joins me. We're going to be talking about another use for blockchains and tokens and things like that called Pillar. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Jonathan Bennett, episode 489, recorded June 27th, 2018. Pillar. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/floss. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, little projects, projects you may be using every day and not be aware of it, projects you may be wanting to download and play with right after this show. Joining me once again is my lovely and talented co-host, Jonathan Bennett. Jonathan Bennett. Let me see if I get my name right. Sorry. Jonathan Bennett. It just
Benedict,
sounded better
yes.
with all those extra syllables. Yes, that's great. So Jonathan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here once again.
It's good to have you here because that's always handy when I have a co-host to be able to bounce questions off of during the show, things like that. I am, once again, as I said, I was going to be last week, I am in the kitchen set of my Tijuana apartment. So if you see refrigerator magnets over to the left there, they've been there unmoved for months. So I haven't actually touched the magnets. So they're always in exactly the same place. They got some words and phrases up there. So that's kind of cool. So anyway, we have a wonderful, interesting show today, as we often do. We're going to bring on in a few minutes David Siegel, who is the founder and CEO of the Pillar Project. So the Pillar Project is building the world's best cryptocurrency and token wallet that will evolve to become your personal digital assistant. So this is, we went through a phase where we were doing like cloud shows. Then we went through a phase where we were doing like container shows. Seems like more often than not, we're doing blockchain shows. So this seems to be one of those in there. We'll have to ask David exactly what distinguishes this from the hundreds of other blockchain things that are actually happening in the world these days. And by blockchain, I'm talking about, many of you are probably familiar with Bitcoin, which is probably the best and most well-known use of blockchain. It's a way of having a public ledger. And in Bitcoin's particular case, it's a way of having a public ledger for the transfer of actual things of value, in this case, Bitcoin, back and forth, and including creating Bitcoin by doing proof of work, and then exchanging Bitcoin with other people pseudonymously. So you do have an ID in the Bitcoin network, and people can trace tech on that. What do you know about this so far?
Not a whole lot more than you said. I think of blockchain as kind of being like the laser, in that when it was first invented, it was the coolest thing ever that there wasn't a good use for. And blockchain seems to be still coming into its own about the practical uses. It will be interesting to see the larger, as blockchain as the buzzword of the month as it is, it will be interesting to see, years and years down the line what it turns into. But for now, interesting to look at one of these projects that try to bring some of this together in a personal assistant. I'm interested to hear more about that, how that works. But not exactly a whole lot of information about this particular project yet.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we're going to be asking David to describe to us in just a moment. But before we bring him on, I do have a very important message, because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. The mortgage experience wasn't keeping up with the times. It was dated, and it needed a client-focused technological revolution. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. It's powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds. Based on your income, assets, and credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all the home loan options for which you qualify and find the one that's just right for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/floss. That's rocketmortgage.com/FLOSS. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for sponsoring Floss Weekly. And now let's go ahead and bring on David. David Siegel, welcome to the show.
Guys, Randall and Jonathan, great to see you.
Cool. And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm in Shoreditch, London, on a beautiful sunny day in London. It's just bright sun out there.
That's not supposed to happen. I think it's supposed to be cloudy every day there, right?
I'm going to show you. It's amazing. I have a great...
No, it's okay. It's okay. We trust you. We believe you. That's fine.
It's fantastic. So
All right.
Excited
so,
you know, with you guys.
Yeah. You know what you're up against. We've done not hundreds, but maybe a dozen blockchain shows. How is this different? Give us the 30,000-foot view. What is specialized about Pillar that makes it different from every other blockchain?
Can we do blockchain 101 real quick, or do you want me to just go straight to the
Pillar? Please do. Awesome. Yeah, that'd be great.
Blockchain 101, because people don't understand it. And, you know, you said Bitcoin is sort of pseudonymous, and it's very tricky. A lot of people don't understand this stuff. So you could get Bitcoin from somebody and then move them around and grow your store of value in Bitcoin and never be identified. But if you ever get to an exchange, then the exchanges will have your personal information, and that way you could be identified. But you could actually live a crypto life and make plenty of money, just live everything in Bitcoin and buy homes and cars and everything with Bitcoin, and then be pretty difficult to identify you, actually. So Bitcoin blockchain is, this is important, blockchain is a shared ledger that everyone trusts to be accurate forever.
Uh-huh.
And that's it. That's it. There's no blocks and no chains. In 10 or 20 years, we'll get rid of the blocks and chains. We'll do something even better. So it's a shared ledger. What's cool about the shared ledger is that we don't keep separate ledgers anymore. We magically bring them together and we work on the same ledger. It's the same ledger that you use to keep track of all your money in your bank account. And the government keeps track of, for example, how much money you make. And then in April, you say how much money you make. And the government says how much money they think you made, and you reconcile. Unfortunately, the government always wins that argument, right? But often separate ledgers are different, and there's a lot of work to reconcile them, and there's a lot of paperwork and payments and processes and settlements that have to take place, and the blockchain eliminates that. And it sounds simple, but when you can program a blockchain to execute commands, that's called programmable money. And when you add all those things up, that's pretty much the same things that banks do, and insurance companies, and even governments, and registrars, and many other government services. More or less, the blockchain can do all that now. So it's kind of like having your own IT department that's just always running, and it's always reliable.
And so, but this isn't any new notion, though. I mean, how is Pillar unique in this aspect?
Right. So there are a lot of there are several cryptocurrencies people have probably heard of. There are now thousands. And there are token sales to raise money for projects. And we had a token sale. Well, it's called an ICO last July. We raised about $20 million. And what I told people in our white paper was that we would build a wallet for your phone. That's the cheap version right there. The actual software version is still in development, but we will build a version for your phone that's just a development version that will, first of all, be a wallet, and that lets you store cryptocurrencies. It will also be an exchange, so you can exchange cryptocurrencies, but then you'll start to do interesting things with it. And this is all based on a book I wrote in 2010 called Pull, about changing the business world from the world of push to the world of pull. From pushing things down the supply chain to us individuals pulling. And I'll give you a quick example.
Please.
A mortgage, for example. You'd have, in my world, you'll have all your financial data in the Pillar wallet, and you'll own it, you'll have access to it. And then if you want financial services or you want to borrow, then you'll say how much you want to borrow, and all the mortgage providers will come to you and bring you their offers the wallet will pull offers to you, similar to on eBay. You know, you see all the offers, and then you can sort them by price or ratings or any number of different, you know, priorities. And then you can choose the one that's right for you. So in our wallet, you own everything. We don't. It's the opposite of Facebook. The blockchain allows you to own your assets, and you have the secret passwords that form the ownership of those assets. Could even be a mortgage, a home, a car. You can own many, many different things with tokens. Could be capital, could be diamonds, gold. You can own tokens that represent gold. It shows that you're the owner of them. And those things will all be yours under your control. And if the FBI comes to me and says, okay, you've got to give us that data on that Randall guy. We need to see what he's got. I don't have it. It's decentralized. You're the one who's in full control of all your assets and all your data. So the same with your medical information. You'd have all your history of everything, every test, every prescription, every doctor visit will be in your possession on your wallet, and you'll be in charge when you go to see the doctor. You'll be able to register with just a click on the phone, say, okay, I'm here, a new patient. And then the phone will say, well, do you want to give some relevant information to the doctor that might help him or her make a decision? And you can say, sure, here's my previous data. It's all under your control. So that's a bit different.
So I'm still a bit confused, because if this is – I understand Bitcoin in the sense that the public transactions have to be part of the public record. But now it's sounding like you're wanting me to put my medical information into some sort of public ledger. How does that reduce my privacy?
Good. Sure. That's a good point. So you've got an online bank, I imagine, and you can log into your bank. When you use your password, that decrypts the information and gives it to you. If someone else has your password, he can get that information. But the bank employees generally can't get it. So it's about encryption. So we'll put encrypted information into the blockchain, and only someone with the password can get that information. So your medical records can live safely on the blockchain. It's actually better than on a server in the cloud, because it's less hackable. And then when you want it, or you want to pass it to someone else, it's the password that unlocks the information and makes it valuable to someone else.
Well, now it sounds like you're putting it all behind, not to mix metaphors, but the weak link of the chain, which is my ability to remember the passwords I have.
Ah, sure. Now you've got to remember your bank password, or what happens? Well, you're going to have to call the bank and say, I don't remember my password. And they'll say, oh yeah, we've heard that before. And so you're going to have to go through a lot of rigmarole to reinstate your bank account if you lose your password or get a new password. And it's the same thing here. It's in our world, the cryptocurrency world, it's up to you to maintain your passwords. Fortunately, there are password managers that help you do just that. And you then have a password for your password manager. You give that password, and then it helps you with all the different, maybe hundreds of passwords that you have to remember. That's a good thing with or without the blockchain. But yeah, what we're trading off, Randall, is that data centers can be hacked. And the more data, the more value in a single data center, the more hackers want to get in it, the more energy they'll put into getting it. So this is called atomization of value. We're getting the value out to the endpoints. I only have, you know, however much I have in my bank account is much, much less than all the people with all the money in one big bank. And so by taking it out to the edges where we own it, it's the hackers have much less desire for it. And by the way, it's harder to hack. Every single one of the Fortune 500 companies, and this includes Google has been hacked successfully. Every single one. The blockchain has never been hacked. No big public blockchain has ever been hacked. There have been attacks on exchanges and other applications. The blockchain itself has never been successfully hacked.
I'm going to challenge that, Jonathan. I'm probably going to say exactly the same thing. There was a big Ethereum hack back about a couple years ago, and that's because the contracts were written in such a way that they had loopholes. What's going to keep a pillar from having
that? That is not the blockchain. That is somebody who wrote some code that had some bad code in it. And I lost a little bit of money because I did it as an experiment for the DAO just to see what would happen. That money was then reinstated because they reset the blockchain. But the blockchain itself has never lost money. Only smart contracts, exchanges, things built on top of it have been hacked, but not the blockchain.
That's the substance of what you're trying to do. Pillar is effectively some contracts on top of a blockchain, right?
No, it isn't. It's actually we don't really do smart contracts. We just give you the ability to store your data encrypted, and you can actually store it wherever you like. You can store it on Amazon Web Services. You could store it on your own computer. It doesn't matter. We don't care where you store it. The key is that it's encrypted and that you hold the private keys. You maintain those passwords. If you lose those passwords, you lose your data. If you hang on to those passwords, it's almost impossible to break.
Okay, Virgil in the chat room has.
Much more likely to be hacked at a bank than you are to be hacked with your information, with your encrypted keys sitting on the blockchain.
Yeah, so Virgil in the chat room actually has a great question. It says, what level of encryption does this have? And is it end-to-end?
It's just technical for your audience. You can look it up. This is the same level of encryption that Bitcoin uses. It's called an SHA-256. It's a problem that you would need all the world's computers, something like a billion years, to be able to crack with brute force. That will eventually be cracked through quantum computing. And that's at least 10 and probably closer to 15, 20 years away. And at that time, have quantum encryption that will begin. But for right now, it's effectively impossible. If it were possible to do it, there are Bitcoin addresses that hold billions of dollars, and they've never been cracked. There's tons of value there, never been cracked. You'd have to guess a very long number that is computationally close to impossible to guess.
David, so you've talked about – sorry, want to jump in. You've talked about pushing all of this data into the Pillar blockchain, which sounds interesting.
No, it's not the Pillar blockchain. It'll be on various blockchains. We'll use various blockchains. We don't expect to have our own.
Okay, that's interesting. That was one of the later questions I was going to have. But how do you avoid inflating the size of the overall ledger? So, for example, whenever someone goes to get started with Bitcoin, it is a several-hour-long process now to download the entirety of the ledger to get started. And if we're pushing all of this data into a ledger, it's going to get unwieldy very quickly. How do you avoid that problem? Sure.
Well, as I said, first of all, there's a lot of computer scientists working on blockchain scaling. It does take a while to get the whole blockchain set up. It is less than a terabyte still. It's actually not that much data. I believe the Ethereum blockchain, which I think is several times larger, is still less. I think it's less than two terabytes. It's not that big. But as I said before, Jonathan, you will put your data wherever you like. The key is that it'll be encrypted. You can stick it in broad daylight anywhere you want. It's encrypted. It's basically, for all intents and purposes, impossible to crack. And you'll hold the key in your wallet. You'll use the wallet to unlock the data. And all you have to do is manage your password. Now, it's possible to get, for somebody to say, hey, I'm your best friend. I really need your private key. You better send it to me right now. If you do, that would be a bad idea because you don't want to send your best friend your private key either. There are safe ways to store your password and your private keys. And we will be we're going to use what we call kind of industry best practice right now for that, but we have even better ideas later about how to even make it more safe.
So is the idea really that you put your kind of simplify the way I understand this, you put your encryption key, so you've got your data, you upload that to Google Drive
anywhere,
or wherever, and then the key that unencrypts that, the key gets encrypted and that goes on your blockchain. And then you've got the ability with the blockchain to give someone else that key so that they can get to your data. Is that kind of how these moving parts work together?
More or less, yes. And there will be pipes and connections between these systems so that the data can flow fairly easily. That's all being built now. This is kind of new land. The cool thing is that there's no data centers involved. It's ridiculously redundant and it's never been hacked. It's insanely close to impossible, effectively impossible to hack.
And how far out is this? Are we weeks away from having Pillar working, or is it still years and years out?
Let me give you an example, if I may. We are working with a group in New York to put prescriptions on the blockchain. And your doctor would send your prescription to your Pillar wallet, not to the pharmacy. And your Pillar wallet would then help you find the best deal for you on a prescription. There might be a better deal on a mail order, or you might want the one around the corner or the one that has it in stock. You'll be able to choose the pharmacy. And then all you do is you just send what we call a signed order from the wallet to the pharmacy, and they will get legally get your prescription, and you'll be able to pick it up just by showing them an ID card. But the cool thing is you're in control, and on your second refill, you may be traveling, you may want to try to save money, or you may need it in a hurry. Again, you can decide which pharmacy will fill that prescription. And then the cool thing is all of your prescriptions will be encrypted in your Pillar wallet forever, so that you have access to that. Right now, you may not know this, but it's illegal for you to request your full prescription history, and any drug company can legally buy your prescription history for $700, and you can't.
That sounds perfect. That's exactly how that should work.
That's our government at work. So this is more about giving control of data to people, and that's what my book was about, Pull.
Hmm. So you guys did an ICO, an initial coin offering. Tell us a little bit more about that process, how that went. Then I obviously have some follow-up questions about that.
Sure. We had a kind of famous one because I wrote up the blow-by-blow story. You can read it at thetokenhandbook.com or theicohandbook.com. It was amazing. It was 4 days of my life, well, plus 3 months that I will never forget. But we had we had a tremendous demand. So our pre-sale was about $4.5 million in 30 minutes. And then our main sale over 4 days, we collected 20 million from more than 10 million, from more than 10,000 people. So a lot of small token buyers who really believed in the dream and didn't want Mark Zuckerberg and Google and Microsoft and Facebook and big companies owning their data. I mean, where is your data? Think about where your personal data is. It's in maybe 5 different hospitals, maybe 10 hospitals, doctor's offices, insurance companies, banks, money managers. You know, your data is all over the place. And I said, you should be in charge of it. You should have it under your control, and you should give it out if you want to. And people bought that. People said, yes, I want those tokens. So they have those tokens. We have a team of 50 people now. We're building the world's simplest, easiest to use wallet. And when the wallet comes out, and it'll be in alpha in about 3 weeks and then beta sometime in August, when you get the wallet, you'll be able to store your cryptocurrencies and tokens. That's kind of normal for a crypto wallet. And then when you want to transact, you will use your Pillar tokens. So you'll pay like a subscription fee in whatever, like $1 or $2 a month in Pillar tokens costs. You'll pay like, you know, per month so many Pillar tokens, depends on the price, but it'll come out to about $1 a month. And then you'll be able to do transactions like managing your prescription, transaction like buying and selling cryptocurrencies. Another thing about our wallet is we'll have e-commerce. So you'll be able, I hope by September, maybe by October, you'll be able to buy a Pillar t-shirt. There'll be a Pillar store in the wallet. You'll be able to buy a Pillar t-shirt, and then it will come in the mail. Then from there, we'll have lots and lots of developers and e-commerce people putting their products and services on our wallet. So it'll be a whole ecosystem, sort of like eBay and Amazon combined. The cool thing, because it's open source, is that we have no profit model. We make no money on it. It's got to be less than Amazon, because Amazon builds a profit into it and we don't. So whoever wants to put products and services onto our wallet, we'll just get out of the way and let you do business with them. And we have no fees for setting up this ecosystem.
I'm sure we will dive into that question about open source and profit models in just a moment. I could just imagine Randall over there beside himself wanting to say something about it. But first, a tangent. So with Pillar and with doing the ICO, you guys did essentially create your own cryptocurrency when that ICO happened, right?
It's a token. I think of a currency as a general purpose unit of value inside a system. A general purpose, meaning you can do almost anything with it in the system. A token is a specific purpose unit of value. The only thing you can do with our token is use it to buy things in our Pillar ecosystem. It's no good to any other system.
Okay. So that about 50%, about halfway answers the follow-up question to that. We're seeing such a huge proliferation of all of these coins that exist. Is it sustainable to have 1, 2, 3, 5, I don't know how many there are now, 5,000 maybe, different tokens and currencies that are blockchain? Is that even sustainable?
It's about as sustainable as having 5,000 startups. After 5,000 startups are funded, how many are left 3 years later? 50, 60, 100 maybe out of 5,000, not that many. So that's about the same ratio, I expect. I expect that at least 90% of these projects will die, and I expect 5 to 10% of them to change the way we use data, interact, do things, and pave the way for what comes next. So that's the creative destruction of venture funding.
Of those, say 5,000, just to use a round number, how many of those do you anticipate Pillar having some level of support for? Is the game plan to be able to do all of them in Pillar, or are you going to pick the 10 most popular? What is that going to look like?
Let's not think of these as coins. Let's think of them mostly as tokens. Coins are for blockchains. Each blockchain has its own coin. Every project has its own token. So some tokens would, for example, represent a gram of gold. Another token would represent a kilowatt minute of energy. Another token might represent storage on hard drives or computing power. So to the extent that people want to trade these things, that's our goal, is that our exchange will be able to let you trade these things if you want. The ones you'll use in our system, at the moment, we only think that the Pillar token will be used in our system, but that could change too. We might accept other tokens as payment or use for various services in the wallet. It's a big ecosystem. We're trying to, I wrote this whole book called Pull, and we're trying to do all of it in one web app, one mobile app called the Pillar Wallet. So it's going to grow and grow.
Are Pillar tokens mineable, or is there a set amount of them?
No.
How does that work?
No, basically no tokens are mineable. And so let me just jump to Randall's question and explain our tokenomics, because it's very similar to most ICOs economics, okay? And many ICOs are open source and have exactly the same business model as we do. So we sold roughly a third of all tokens in our sale. We offered about 70% for sale, but we only sold a third. If we had met our full goal and sold out, we would have had $50 million. And some projects, as you know, raised more than 100 a year ago. So we sold a third. And so that means we kept two thirds. Once you issue the tokens, there's only so many ever. You can never mint new ones. And there's no such thing as mining with tokens. They're made, and now we have 70%, and our token holders have 30%. And as the project becomes more popular, and as people get value and utility out of our product, our wallet, they will pay a subscription fee every month that's called an access token, just like paying your gym membership, for the little, QR code that gets you into the gym or onto an airplane. And that will cost, $1 to $2 a month. And you'll use the token to then be able to do transactions. Again, these transactions we take no part of. We get out of the way and let buyers and sellers find whatever prices they want. We just charge the $1 to $2 a month access fee. And that, if it's successful, if people like it, will drive up the price as people want to get in and want more of these tokens to get in and use the wallet. As millions of people use the wallet, you'll need to buy a couple Pillar tokens to be able to run it. The price of the Pillar token will rise. And guess what? That increases the value of our holdings in the back room where we have 500 million tokens. And this is exactly the model that the Ethereum Foundation has. As their tokens that they made at the beginning rise in value, they can just cash them out anytime and pay their salaries. So you have the initial amount raised, and after that, you've got more tokens that you can then sell.
So do you guys have a game plan for what happens if part of the community decides to fork the Pillar token blockchain?
Sure, sure. It's not a blockchain. The blockchain is Ethereum. So it's just a token. You could easily take our product and fork it. And then you could say, hey, this is free. There's no tokens. Or you can make your own token and modify it to run your token. That's fine. Our product needs back-end services that we run. So our product won't run without those back-end services. And those are what your Pillar tokens pay for. So we run those back-end services at cost. It would be a little technical to explain what they are, but they make our wallet much easier to use than any other wallet. If anybody out there has used a wallet before, you know you have to cut and paste long numbers and then do test transfers and see if it worked and go to blockchain explorers and all this rigmarole to try to figure out how to move money, really, how to move value. And on our platform, you'll just, Jonathan, I'll have your name in my address book, and I'll just send you, say, 2 Ether. That'd be nice, wouldn't it? I'll just send it by name. I'll just say, to Jonathan, 2 Ether, here you go. And there'll be good communication from your wallet to my wallet, so we don't have to see with blockchain explorers or anything. It's all done by the back-end services that we're building, and that's what your $1 or $2 a month pay for. So a fork wouldn't have access to those services. They'd have to build their own of those.
So I think a little light bulb just went ding above my head there. Are you guys – so you have a token, but does that token live on the Ethereum blockchain? Is that what I understood you to say?
And almost all of them do. 98% of ICO tokens are Ethereum ERC-20 tokens that live on the Ethereum blockchain. That's right.
Okay. So suddenly things about this conversation just made a lot more sense.
That's true with almost every ICO.
That is good to know. I'll tuck that little bit of information away. ICOs in general have begun to attract lots and lots of attention from regulators and governments and things of that nature. What do you see the future being of the ICO business model or funding model?
Sure. So we have 9 billion year to date in ICO funding. We have 1 billion in venture capital. So that speaks to the unmet desire for risk capital to help fund interesting projects. Again, 90% at least will die. But the regulators, especially the very vocal regulators at the SEC, have said, well, I know a security when I see one. I'm not going to give you the exact recipe, but I'll give you the guidelines. And if you meet the criteria for a security, then we're going to assume you're selling securities and that you'll have to follow the rules. So as a consequence, I'm an American living in London. We just block out Americans. We don't think Americans are interested in innovation. So we just sell those tokens to other people. Americans are effectively blocked from almost all ICOs now. On the other hand, there is a new trend coming called security tokens, and we are going to be issuing what we call equity tokens. That's so startups can sell their stock in a token and not an access token, not a utility token, but a stock token. And that is regulated, and we're building a regulated broker dealer in New York to do that. So there will be two kinds of ICOs, the equity ICO or the security ICO and the non-security ICO.
I want to jump in here a little bit and ask about the technology behind this. So you showed the icon on your phone that obviously you've got a mobile app that you're working on. What are you building that with?
We were building it with Ionic, and then we threw that all in the trash. and we switched to React Native. We could not make Ionic do what we wanted, not even close. So that was a learning experience and 3 months down the drain. And now we started again with React, and we brought in some React people. And I would say almost all of it is React, but we are later planning to do a bit of native development to make the user interface do more of what we want. But we're starting to get what we want out of React, so it's working pretty well.
And that also means, therefore, you're already cross-platform Android and iOS, right?
That's right. And then we can customize it and create that those extra last mile for various animations and things if we want to on native.
And what kind of server-side tech do you have?
I know it's almost all Node, and I can tell you that it's server-based, but that if this means anything to you, we will be going towards serverless Lambda architecture. Does that – I don't know if
– I know exactly what that is. It's probably about a third of my audience just got lost, but that's okay. I know exactly what that is, yes.
You know much more about it than I do. So let's just say it's Node.js. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it's close enough. That's right. So you're writing JavaScript in the sky, in the cloud, and there'll be things to trigger right. it happening, and that's all good stuff. Yeah, that's actually the way a lot of companies are moving, because the scaling rate for that stuff is so amazing. It's so dirt cheap to not have to maintain a server and keep having security updates and keeping it running even when you don't have transactions coming in. That's all just sort of dealt with the scaling systems of AWS Lambda and things like that. So and Google Clouds is like that too.
Remember that when our blockchains scale, Randall. Remember when our blockchains scale and we have smart contracts, that will be a big competitor, because smart contracts running on blockchains are these, unstoppable programs that you don't really even need an IT department for. You just stick it on the blockchain, and the blockchain does the rest.
So what are you actually – I'm still trying to find the value added here. So it's not just an Ethereum contract system. You're adding some additional value. How would you describe that value?
Yeah, we don't even use contracts much. What we're doing is giving you the chance to – buy and sell products and services in our wallet. So think of it like an eBay app where people can offer, or an e-commerce app where people can offer things. Here's maybe the best way to think of it, Randall. You use Kayak before to make a flight.
Oh, yeah.
So in Kayak, you specify the day and the destination where you want to go. And then what you can do is you can move sliders for the takeoff time or the one stop, two stop, and things like which airports and so forth. And then you see the offers change as you move the sliders, right?
Sure. Yeah. You're
familiar with that. And why? Because those offers are in a common format that lets you compare flights, apples to apples comparisons. It's a format. It's a data format. This is what my book was about, that lets you do that. And our goal, and this is what the white paper that I wrote in the book is about, that you'll be able to compare everything apples to apples just like that. So right now you'd think, well, if I need a lawyer, I've got to go to a bunch of lawyers' websites or a babysitter or something. So, but then there are these kind of centralized comparison engines, a babysitter's finding, site, or lawyer comparison engine, or a comparison engine for laptops or furniture, whatever you like. And our goal, and those are run by private companies on centralized servers. And our goal is to give you the power to compare anything, any product or service, and see the offers, and then just take it directly. And we charge nothing. We are out of the way. It's you dealing directly with that third party, and we don't mark anything up. So in my ideal world, it doesn't look a heck of a lot different from shopping at Amazon or eBay. But also there's services like, lawyers or taxi cabs or hotel rooms and rent-a-cars, but that there's no company there that's charging money to present the platform. The platform itself is free. That's the difference. Now, there's more that you'll be able to use your personal data for your prescriptions, for your doctor visits, and for your banking and your investing and school information, work history, finding a job. We're going to sort of, like I would say, kayakize everything in your life.
Okay, but I'm still confused, because the thing is, you keep talking about this being decentralized, and yet the pillar organization is in the center of all this, and I can't separate that if I don't like the way Pillar's running.
It's not. We don't have your data. The FBI can hold a gun to my head, and I don't have your data. I don't have it. It's in your wallet. It's under your control. I'm just writing some open source software that you pick up, and then you use that to put your identity on, your assets, your history, all that you do, and I have no control over it.
Okay,
there's
but
one
let's
thing
say
I can control. There's one thing, Randall, I can control. Sure. I'm going to control that people will not be able to buy drugs or guns or weapons of mass destruction or slaves or, you know, things that we don't want, just similar to eBay's policy. But other than that, as long as the offers are in the right format, you'll compare everything apple to apples and you'll just do business directly with those people, and I have nothing to do with it. I will not have a record of your transactions. I will not know.
Again, I'm still playing devil's advocate on this because I think there's some loopholes here. Yeah, I know. It's fine. But you still require me to participate with your organization to have the benefits of having now uploaded and encrypted all of my data. So you're essentially always holding my data hostage for that $2 a month fee, right?
No. You could easily get out of it. The $2 a month fee is just for transactions. So you could store, you can cold store. You could move your stuff to somewhere else. You could move other. Somebody else could say, "Hey, Pillar users, move all your stuff to this other wallet, and we'll do other things to it, and that's fine. It's your data."
Okay, and so let's shift it slightly because I want to talk more about implementation now. So you say this is open source. Are you getting contributions from outside your organization now to make this better?
We're not open yet. So just like many open source projects, we're closed until we release. But then we expect to, yeah. We're also integrating something called Signal. Have you heard of Signal?
No, sorry.
It's a very secure messaging protocol that every single message session between users has its own private key. So even if you get the private key, that's only for one session. I believe some groups are using it. I don't want to misspeak. But it's my understanding it's the highest level privacy you can get because if somebody gets the private key, he only gets the private key for one conversation. So we'll be integrating that. That's, by the way, people should try the Signal app. It's amazing. It's great. And we'll have Signal running in our app, and you'll be able to make a Signal phone call in our app. So you just be able to call people right in our wallet. And it's fully encrypted.
Okay, so you're not currently developing in an open source manner yet. You're still doing everything
that's
in-house.
Right.
Okay,
that's
and
right. That's right.
So you expect that when the release happens, that this will all be, like, say, on GitHub or something?
Oh, sure. It is on GitHub. We'll just open it up. Sure, of course. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So you're actually using GitHub privately.
Oh, sure. Of course.
Project. Okay. All right.
Yeah,
all
because we like Microsoft so much.
Yes. <right. laughs> Oh, yeah. That's the new change, isn't it? That now the GitHub is owned by Microsoft. Oh, scary, scary.
The world was not ready.
Yes, it's
well,
funny.
That's okay.
It's
we're talking on Skype.
Yeah, I know, because it's still the best solution out there. I keep begging the open source community to come up with something that's better than Skype. And it works consistently, and they have not. They have not. I keep the challenge going, and Skype still is the best at adapting to various levels of bandwidth issues and reconnection issues. It's still Skype. It's
what
still
can
the
I
best.
Say?
It's not
an
open closed
world, isn't it?
Yes, and it's not the best thing out there. It's kind of mediocre, but it's still the best thing out there, which is really, it sucks, but it sucks less than everything else. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
Right. So look, with Zuckerberg and company, they can find out what you're typing your messages. They can read your messages.
Sure.
With me, your messages will go through my server, but they'll be fully encrypted, and I'll never be able to know what you're talking about ever. I have no idea.
Cool. And so can I ask how big your development team is?
It's about 30 developers right now. And we've got an office in Lithuania. We've got about four people, maybe six people now in Lithuania.
Okay. And how did you select the kind of people that you want to work on this? Are they have a history with other mobile apps?
Oh, pretty random, guys. It was we started by asking for volunteers. Which was great because it was people who really believed in our project. And we got some very high quality people that way. And then we needed more high quality people. So we started just plain old interviewing and hiring, which I think is a bit silly, but that has worked out. And then we actually have gone through a few recruiters for a few people. And I think we'll end up doubling our development team between now and the end of the year. So we're continually looking for good JavaScript, Node, and React front-end people all the time.
David, I'm going to ask another hard question. I'm sorry. I promise we did not bring you on here to ambush you. But I will say this. When you're trying to do something as innovative and as big as what you're trying to do, I think there's just by the nature of it, there's going to be some hard questions. You mentioned that you don't plan, or you very much plan to not allow the selling of weapons, drugs, slaves, things like that. How do you accomplish that if all of these things are encrypted everywhere?
That's a really good question, because people could say, you know, this is just an ear of corn on the cob and it's actually a weapon, right? So more or less the way eBay does it today, and it's probably not perfect. I'm not sure if on eBay you can buy a bump stock, but you might be able to, right? Could you buy all the parts you might need to buy to build a gun? This is pretty difficult. And when you try to do these things and you put down rules, people try to game the system and get around it. So, you know, we're not really going to say, here's the way it's going to work. We will kind of approve some trusted companies to onboard other companies and products on. So for example, in the area of sporting goods, we would find a company, maybe a distributor or so, who will do a good job of onboarding people who want to sell products and services on our platform. And we'll trust them to, you know, build rules, adhere to them, put policies that we think are generally right. There's a lot of gray area on these things. So sometimes you just have to make judgment calls about what even is a gun. And some people, you know, will be furious. We've already had people yelling at me on Twitter about the gun thing. Other people will be approved for other things. For example, I am also CEO of a for-profit company called 2030. And 2030 will be getting licenses and onboarding ICOs, because we're building an ICO platform that is much safer and simpler than the crazy way we do ICOs today. So we'll have trusted partners help us do that. And I'm sure there will be, you know, screw-ups, complaints, gray areas, decisions, judgments. It won't be easy.
So I'm reminded of a news story from back a couple of years past. The Daily Stormer. Horrible group of people. I think almost everyone agrees. I mean, that's just the consensus that everyone comes to. And they were being hosted by Cloudflare. And the CEO of Cloudflare got up one morning and said, "This is ridiculous. Why are we doing this?" And he made the phone calls and kicked them off of their platform.
That was Matthew Prince, an old friend of mine.
Yes. And then he said later, "Well, there wasn't really any particular reason why we did it. I just felt like doing it that morning," which kind of terrified a lot of us.
He had to defend that. That was a tough one for him. That was a tough day for him. We're going to take this one thing at a time. I'm hoping that 99.9% of the stuff is beneficial to people and they want it and it's pulled because they desire it. And the same, we want to build Kayak for renting a flat or a bike or buying furniture for your home. So I hope 99.9% of it is that, and 0.1% will be edge cases and we'll have to deal with it. We already have a token holders council and we're giving more and more power to our token holders collectively, and maybe, you know, the community will vote on things and help establish policy. That'd be fine with me.
And then one final question from me. I'll let Randall take it back after this. What about critical mass? It seems like for this to really take off, it's got to have a certain amount of critical mass being able to stick together. How are you going to get that initial buy-in from obviously people, but also companies selling services? Is there a game plan for getting to that point to where it actually begins to sustain itself?
Yes. So good question. We have 10,000 people who bought the tokens. We have 20,000 token holders now because of trading. And there hasn't been much trading, but we know we have about 20,000 people holding tokens. And they're our go-to audience. We've got about 20,000 people on our mailing list. We have a big conference. We call it an unconference coming up in 3 weeks in Vilnius, Lithuania, where people are coming from around the world to kind of like a pillar jamboree to learn what's going on, how it works, how to develop. So there's quite a bit of interest from people to develop for our platform so they can put their products and services on the platform. So we got the first, I'd say the next 6 months pretty well covered. I think we'll get to a couple hundred thousand downloads fairly organically. And then you're right, then it starts, right? Then it's a challenge to get to bridge toward the consumers. And I can say, Jonathan, that if people are interested in cryptocurrencies, and let's just say that the price of these things don't just, you know, tank, but they continue to look promising, then they're going to say, huh, maybe we should get into this too. And then they're going to hear the word wallet for the first time. And then it will be clear that the Pillar wallet is just far and away the easiest. If your grandmother's going to use a wallet, it's going to be the Pillar wallet. So we're designing for that next generation of consumers. Kind of think of it as the Apple design team for cryptos. It's got to get easier to use than it is now. And so we hope that'll be a big part of the appeal. Plus, we'll have partners. Here's a good example. There's an exchange that's well known. We won't give the name yet, but they're very interested in being a market maker on our platform. And they said, well, you bring us the customers and we'll give you half of the spread, you know, their profit on each trade. And we said, oh, no, we want you to give that half of the spread back to our customers and charge them half of what you would charge on any other platform. And they said, sure, no problem. So we'll automatically have an exchange where you'll have lower spreads than anywhere else because that profit goes to you.
So you said something a bit earlier, and I thought it was sort of interesting. You said you had 10,000 initial investors, but now the number is 20,000, token holders. How do you know those aren't the same? How do you know that's not the same 10,000 people that have decided to fork themselves so that they look like two different people?
It could be. There hasn't been much trading. We haven't encouraged trading. I've kept the token off most exchanges. What we know really, Randall, is that there are more tokens out there now because we've seen those addresses, but we don't know who they are. And we do have 20,000 people on our mailing list. And there's, from Twitter followers and Telegram activity, we know we've got the initial people who are really still very much looking forward to our wallet and can't wait till to show it to friends, to use it and get safer with their cryptocurrencies, especially when we have ICOs on the platform. We'll get quite a few people coming in because the ICOs will want a safer, less fishable, less hackable way to get tokens than we have today, which is really a nightmare.
So how do you think you're going to be able to establish the kind of trust that you'll need? And let me describe this by a specific example. Let's say, so at some point, let's say I decide to deal guns. Okay, you're either going to directly, as Pillar, the organization, decide that my transaction shouldn't be allowed anymore on the system, or you're going to have a third party who has vetted me or not vetted me in this case to do that. How does this fit in with the idea of a decentralized system? It sounds like you're creating monopolies everywhere.
Well, I don't know. I'd say 99.9% of all the stuff will be non-controversial, and that'll, of course, be decentralized. We won't be in the middle of it. And maybe there will be other systems. You could have your own ICO for a gun exchange. That'd be fine with me. It's just not in our values, so we're not going to allow it. But that's just going to be a tiny, tiny fraction of the activity that goes on our platform.
So, again, though, how do you think you'll be able to establish trust in this whole system?
I think the good news is that the trust will be between you, the P2P, between users, because we're not in the way. We are not a third party. Nothing goes through us at all. So the trust will be in the same way that you do it with Amazon resellers or eBay. You'd look at their ratings, right? And we will work on a rating system. We're actually interested in a ratings coin. That's called a skin in the game coin. So it's expensive to game it. If you put up a positive rating about something that other people say is not good, there are economic forces that will cost you money to put up false ratings. So we're interested in that. We're interested in generally, you know, letting people build trust, and we're asking people not to trust us I'm not in the middle. I want you to use your wallet. Hey, somebody could even fork our wallet maybe, and there'll be other compatible systems. That's all good. We just want this ecosystem to emerge where people can do business with each other and nobody gets the profit. I mean, eBay makes like $25 million in profit every year. It's not huge, but we're giving that back to our consumers, right? We want the power. And the power of it really, guys, is in the personal data. It's not in the e-commerce. The power of it is when your passport or your driver's license or your insurance information, your medical history, let's say your history of seeing doctors that perhaps even psychiatrists that maybe your employer might want to find out when you're interviewing, that would all be under your control. And if they ask you for that data, you might say, you know, I don't think I want to work at a company that asked me for that data, to be honest. It'll be under your control and not that they call, you know, some centralized company and say, yeah, we'd like to do a medical history search on the following potential employees.
Okay. Hey, we're almost out of time. So now it's time to do the most difficult question you're going to answer the entire hour, which is we're going to do a set math problem. So think of all the things you wanted to talk about and subtract from that all the things we actually asked. And is there anything we left out that you really want to make sure our audience is aware of before I have to let you go?
Well, we're doing this on conference. This is kind of a gift to people. We last year in Slovakia. We're doing this year in Lithuania. You can learn about it at pillarproject.io. It's a free conference, and it's an unconference, so anybody can come and give a talk or lead a workshop on any topic. And it's really fun, and it's great learning. So I encourage people to come learn about it. It's the 15th to the 22nd of July. And sign up for our newsletter because we have new stuff coming all the time. We're kind of actively engaged in dialogue with the SEC. We want to be part of the chains. We want to be part of this new world of decentralization and help lead the way. So this is much of what our newsletter and our videos are all about.
Cool. And I understand you were employee number 2 at Pixar?
That's not true. I was employee number 1. Wow. After Steve Jobs funded the company, which had an original 40 people.
Okay.
So essentially, I was employee number 41 or so. Nice. But I only stayed there a year, and then I went back to Silicon Valley to build my own businesses.
Did you ever bump into Mark Van Wettering?
It was before that. We're talking 1986.
Oh, man. Okay. So even before that, okay. Mark's
first
been there
year,
for quite a number of years. Okay. Yes. All right.
When
but
Steve,
not right
when
now.
I knew Steve Jobs and when at the first year that Steve put money into the company, it was not a film studio. It was a hardware company. It was a computer
right,
company.
Yes. Remember that back in the days. Yes. Mark and I go way back and he highly recommended seeing Coco. So I just watched that last night again. It was a beautiful movie. So yes. Anyway, awesome. That's enough distractions there. I don't know. Are you much of a coder? Because I have a couple of coding questions I want to ask you. So
I'm not. I have a – do you know who Donald Knuth is?
Of course.
I'm his graduate student.
Oh, my God. Okay. Well, then you know a little bit about programming. What's your favorite?
I got my master's degree from Donald Knuth, but it was in digital typography. Remember the tech and metafont?
Yeah.
I was in the tech and metafont group. I did my master's thesis on metafont, and nice. I spent a lot of time with Don. I got to know Don very well.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, hey, it's been a wonderful time talking with you, and I hope it's really raised awareness for your Pillar Project, and we'll see how it all turns out. And I wish you the best of luck.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. That was David Siegel talking to us about Pillar. What did you think there, Jonathan?
Quite the quite the grand aspirations, and I think he's definitely on to some really interesting things, some uses for the blockchain, you know. But I can't get over this idea that the way that they've put this together, and it's just the result of some of the decisions they've made. They've put their company in this place of being a gatekeeper, and you know, when you take the long view of things, that almost always turns out to be a liability. Whether a literal liability for the company, or they're going to get sued because they've kicked somebody off. Or so just for instance, if we take certain things to their logical extreme, we saw our press secretary get kicked out of a restaurant just the other day. And of course, everybody lost their minds about it. But what happens when suddenly you say, okay, we're not going to let anybody that voted for Donald Trump be a part of our platform? You know, I mean, this is kind of taking it to the extreme, like I said. But when you think about that, I mean, that's millions and millions of people that suddenly, if the wrong person wakes up on the wrong side of the bed and says, I really don't like those people, if you have a centralized gatekeeper, you've got, you know, one person or a company that has a whole lot of power to do something like that. And, you know, when you think about open source and the blockchain and how it's supposed to work, getting rid of that centralized gatekeeper is one of the things that, at least in my mind, has always been an important advantage of it. But then you have the other side of it, and that's the question that the Tor project has always bumped into, which is it obviously not blockchain, but it is a similar concept because it's all built on cryptography. With the Tor project, you have all of these just horrible websites that exist. And the Tor project always said, no, we're not the gatekeeper. We don't care. They can do whatever they want to with our technology. And so there's this tension of what do you do when you have, you know, child pornography sites and people selling drugs, people selling hitman services on Tor. I don't know. I guess we haven't come up with a solution yet for what the tech world does, how it solves this problem of getting out of the way and yet not enabling some of these horrible, horrible things.
And you have the issues then also, if you draw a line in the sand, you're going to have false positives and false negatives. And people are going to be upset on both sides of that false statements too. So I don't know. Anyway, like I said, best of luck to the project. Sounds like it's interesting. Oh, yes. Sounds like it's trying to, although the chat room kind of occasionally crossed, it looks like it's solving a problem that doesn't need to be solved yet or can be solved in other ways. I agree, chat room. It's just kind of an interesting show. Anyway, so let's go ahead and talk about what's coming up because we're almost out of time. Coming up next week, I think it is. Yeah, next week, Friendican. Decentralized architecture with no central authority or ownership. Well, now that's a contrast to what we just had. That's great because in this week in blockchain, we're going to be covering once again. I'm just going to change the name of the show. I'm going to just change the name of the show. I think it's going to be better that way. So that's Friendica coming up soon. Next week, I think it is. Free Code Camp. Oh, something completely different. Learn to code for free and donate your coding skills to nonprofits. That sounds like a lot of fun. Aeon Ion, which is a multi-tiered system designed to address unsolved questions of scalability and interoperability in the blockchain networks. Like I said, this week in blockchain. Linstore. Not a blockchain thing, thank God. Highly available DRDB. It's an open source management tool designed to manage block storage devices, not blockchains, block storage, for large Linux service clusters, and primarily used to provide persistent Linux block storage for Kubernetes and OpenShift environments. Just added to the schedule, Hax, which is an open source tool aiming to make online course creation accessible to all instructors. I'll be very interested in this because one of the things I've always wanted to do is create some online courses, and I just don't like the existing tools that are out there. And finally, wrapping up the currently scheduled list, we have Monero, which is cryptocurrency. This week in blockchain again, but private, untraceable, and fungible. If you have any other suggestions, preferably not blockchain, please tell the project leader or community coordinator to email me. Go to twit.tv/floss. It's the homepage for the show. My email address is on there, so you don't even have to write it down. We have a live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays at live.twit.tv. We follow us on Floss Weekly on Google Plus and at Floss Weekly on Twitter. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus and at Merlin on Twitter. We will not have a show on the 4th of July. The studio is taking the week off, so we are also taking the week off. I'm going to be in about 2 weeks. I'm going to be in Norway on a cruise. So I'm actually coming ashore, at least in Bergen. They're setting up some sort of lunch for me. The local Linux users group is going to be there. And last week's guest, I think, was also from Bergen. So this will be interesting if I can bump into him, too. Then I'll be returning down to San Diego. I've got a low-carb conference I'm going to just after the cruise. And then I'm just going to be hanging out. I'm finally going to go to San Diego Zoo. All these years I've been coming into San Diego, never having gone to the zoo. So I'm definitely going to take a tour of the zoo at least one of those days. I'm going to be in Raleigh in October at the All Things Open Conference. I'm going to be actually ahead of that. I will be at Dragon Con, once again, my favorite indulgence conference, speaking on three or four things, including my Flutter talk. So that's going to be really fun to do that there. I'll be at and hopefully in All Things Open. I'm at least there as press, but I'm also hoping to give my Flutter talk there as well, the one-hour introduction to Flutter. I will be at Siegel in Seattle in November, and nothing else currently on the schedule yet, but, you know, I add things all the time. We'll see how it goes. Jonathan, anything you want to plug?
Oh, if we change the name to This Week in Blockchain, we're no longer the earliest show on the Twit network, but we could be the hipsterist show on the Twit network. We should really think about that.
yes, exactly. The hipsterist show. I don't know that. I think I'm too old to qualify for that, unless maybe I got some really cool glasses or something. I don't know. We'll see how that works. But yeah, that'd be great. Okay. Anyway, so thanks, Jonathan, once again for joining me and helping me wade my way through the conversation. And thanks once again, Jonathan.
My pleasure to be here, as always.
All righty, and we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.